mansion house needs haunting, just call Rent a Ghost. We've got spooks and ghouls and freaks and fools at Rent a Ghost. Hear the Phantom of the Opera sing a haunting melody. Remember, what you see is not a mystery, but Rent a Ghost. At your party, be a smarty and hire Rent a Ghost. If you want a fright, climb the spooky heights with Rent a Ghost. You can let our spirits move you, and for fun, play Ghostman's Knock.
Because we in the shop, we hope your knees will lock. That's Rent a Ghost.
Right, well, faithless listeners, here we are in the Diddly Dum Museum. I'm not going to start the podcast just yet because I've got a dilemma. Here we are about to do our special Halloween episode, and I'm just standing outside Mark's bedroom in the museum, and I feel that he's become possessed by some evil force, and I really don't know what to do. So it's been like this all day. Anyway, I've just called up 0800 your mother f**ks in hell, and I think that might be the exorcist at the door now.
Hello, I heard you called for an exorciser.
Oh yes, please, come in.
Right, I'll just bring it in between. It's cold out there, isn't it? Hey, I wish they'd turn off them tubular bells. Hey, follow me everywhere I go, they do.
Come upstairs. You've got to help my friend Mark. I think he's possessed by the devil. I need to
exorcise him. Whoa, hang on a minute. I've heard that one before, sunshine.
I need him exercising in time to start the Diddly Dum podcast this evening.
Right, okay then. Right, you lead the way, sir. I'll keep me wits about me, just in case this is like that time in the retirement home.
Now, here's his bedroom door. Be careful, because he's been a bit strange.
Oh, it's freezing in here.
Mark, we're coming in.
Mark's not here.
He seems to have turned into some kind of... Oh, hang on, what's that? Look at that. His head is revolving around like an owl. Oh, he's puked up some kind of Slovene-looking fungus stuff. Oh, right down me lughole. Oh, dear. Oh. Right, okay. Let's try and get this demon out of your friend. Blow.
You vile creature. Is Mark somewhere inside there?
Show me your tits and I'll tell you. You can't get rid of me. I'm at the US convention watching the Twin Dilemma with Gary Downey.
Oh, good, I think it's working.
Jodie Whittaker wears socks in Hull.
Back to us, Mark.
Oh, gosh. Hello. Sorry about that. I got sent a bottle of shampoo from friend of the show, Gruntly the Ogren. It seems to have had some rather strange side effects.
You're supposed to put it in your hair, Mark, not drink it.
Oh.
Are you alright, Mark? You've been poorly for the last most of today. How are you feeling?
Well, I'm feeling a lot better now, thank you. God, that priest is a bit smelly, isn't he?
Oh, gosh, well, thank you very much, Mr. Exerciser.
It's no problem.
Well, yeah, we can stop with the tubular bells now, thanks.
There we go.
Right, sorry, well, chaps. If you'll just send us your invoice in the post.
Okay, if I write it in my special red pen.
Can you let yourself out of the front door?
I will go out the window.
I wonder if you'd do us a favour. Go out the front door, and once you get onto our front steps, if you just press the intercom, and if you read this piece of paper out to us, would you?
I'll do my best.
Right, Mark, we're late. Yes. We've got to revivify Hayden. Oh. In time to start our special Halloween podcast. Come on, down to the crypts below the museum. Quick, get into the dumbwaiter.
He's very accommodating.
He's from Barcelona.
I was working in the lab late one night when my eyes beheld an eerie sight. For my monster from his slab began to rise, and suddenly, to my surprise,
he did the mash.
He did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
He did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
He did the mash.
He did the monster mash. Whoa. From my laboratory in the castle east, whoa, to the master bedroom where the vampires feast. Whoa. The ghouls all came from their humble abodes, whoa, to get a jolt from my electrode.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
The monster mash.
It was a graveyard smash.
They did the mash.
It caught on in a flash.
They did the mash.
They did the monster mash.
Right, here we are in the crypts, ranged beneath the floor of the Dudley Dum Museum, and here's Hayden on his slab. Right, can you attach these, yes, can you track this electrode to his left ear, Mark, and I'll attach this one to his right?
Yeah, I certainly can.
Okay, and stand back. Oh, I think he's waking. There's life coming back into him.
Oh. Now I know what it feels like to be God. It's a bit boring, actually.
What time is it?
It's 8:28, and we're already nearly an hour late for recording the Halloween podcast.
Oh, sorry, I don't know what happened there. Ah, hi chaps, what am I doing down here in the crypt? Along with the long since deceased former members of the Diddly Dum podcast.
You've been having... Shh! No one's supposed to know what we did with the Rev, Alan, Matt and Alan. Right, Halloween, of course, Faithful Sisters. And just before we start, I'm just going to check that our exterior defences are set up. I've set up our defences just outside the front door to be triggered by a special code word. And if we just hear, just waiting for the exorcist to appear on the intercom. Oh, here we are. Hello, is that you, Mr. Exorcist?
I waited around.
Right, could you read out those words on the card, please?
Trick? Or tree.
Right, I think that should make sure that the kids will stay away. Don't have to buy any candy again this year. Scary night, Faithless Sisters, and welcome to episode 121 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. We are the Crypt Kicker 3. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark. Sorry.
We're here to celebrate Halloween by going through the scariest Doctor Who stories, or rather moments in the Doctor Who stories, as experienced by ourselves and our faithless listeners. Before we start on that, has anything exciting been happening? Mark, you've been rooting around in the Hooseum attic, haven't you? And you found a bit of original artwork, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I did. Yes. As well as the Judge Dredd soap, which I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago.
Yes.
I also came across a piece of original Peter Firmin art from a book which he wrote for, I think it must be from an annual or something, judging by the format. But it's from Ivor the Engine. It, sadly, it doesn't feature Ivor in it, but it does feature Idris and the rest of his dragon family. And it's a beautiful piece of artwork.
And Mr. Jones.
Oh, yes, and yes, and Jones the Steam, sorry, yes.
Ba-da-da!
I'm cured, Mr. Jones, I'm cured.
Yeah, it's a fabulous piece. My girlfriend's bought it for me for a birthday present years ago.
Anyway, picture you can find in our show notes, faithless listeners, or on our Tumblr page, which is diddly dum.
Can I talk about my run?
Your run?
My run.
Tell us about your run, Hayden.
Yeah, so I took part in my final 10K of the year. It was the Great Abington Fun Run, and I managed to do it in 52 minutes, 29 seconds. Bringing up my stats now, I came 159th out of 307 people. So I was very happy with that result, and my second proper race of the year. Third overall, I think, I've ever done in my entire life. So, yeah, very good. And just, you know, winding down now for the rest of the year. And I celebrated with releasing my new book as well.
Oh, well done.
Of course, yes.
Yes, Captain Random and the Eater of Souls, the second Captain Random novel, is now out in all good bookstores and also on Amazon. Not a dig there, Amazon. I love you, really. Or do I? But yes, it's been met with critical acclaim so far. So I've been very happy with the way it's been received and been very happy with how it's selling as well. So can't fault it. Can't fault it. And I've also got loaned out to Mark Cockrum, the Human Palindrones Nerdology podcast, when I was on an episode about writing with Simon Brett and Ian Martin as well. So do check that out.
Oh, yes, that's quite good, that. Yeah.
Oh, thank you.
Links in the show notes, of course.
Have you been watching scary films, Doc?
No.
You've been watching scary television, haven't you?
Oh, Mark and I have finally got round to sync watching the DVD box set of Survivors.
Oh, yeah, it's okay. Just what you need for a bit of post-Brexit relaxation, isn't it? If you thought Terry Nation's Blake 7 was bleak, yes. Hayden, you yeah. Wait till you see Terry Nation's Survivors.
Good Lord.
It is super bleak in a wonderful mid-70s Britain. It's basically, it's like The Walking Dead, but without any of the zombies. Just people traipsing around mid-70s British countryside finding dead people.
It's like the plague in the Silurians had worked and wiped out most of the human race, except the Silurians weren't there.
Only 1 in 5,000 people survive, which makes casting a lot cheaper.
Absolutely, absolutely. Is this the series where you spoke in a previous episode about, was it Patrick Troughton was in it, wearing a hat?
Yes.
And someone said, oh, I like your hat.
Yes, I would like a hat like that, yes. God, that's another bleak episode.
They don't murder the hat, do they?
I'm not saying anything. Yeah, there's some tough tales to come. Basically, though, have you spotted the pattern yet, Doc, on who is good and who is evil?
No.
Basically, if you speak with if you speak in the BBC RP accent or clearly have an upper class accent, then you're probably 90% of the time going to be a good guy. Whereas if you have a working class accent, then you're almost 99% bound to be scum.
What's unusual about that? That's my general rule of thumb for everyday life.
Well, quite.
So which category do we fit in, then? We're the scum, aren't we, Mark? Don't have to break it to me gently.
No, we're too well-spoken to be the cockney and Welsh scumbags.
Is it anybody north of the home counties is scum, then, yeah?
Yes, and some Welsh people.
I see. Oh, so you are scum.
Yeah. Well, we've just met the two little children.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Does the first three episodes are pretty unrelentingly bleak, but then something marvellous happens when suddenly up the road towards our gang of plucky survivors, there comes tottering these two kids wearing adults' clothes. They're about 7 or 8, aren't they? They're called John and Lizzie, and they are an immediate ray of sunshine for the whole thing.
Hello, you look just like my uncle. He died too.
Goodbye.
It's the plague. You're like my uncle and my grandmother. You'll be dead soon. Goodbye.
John and Lizzie, they are the true stars of the survivors.
Talking of bleakness, Hayden, have you got through season C of Blake 7 yet?
No. Stranger Things 3 came along, and then ever since then I've been completely derailed with Blake 7. I think it's probably something I'm going to be catching up with. I've got, I think it's 12 episodes left of Series C and the whole of Series D. That's I think we may have to do a New Year edition of it just to see where I catch up. I've got a bit more downtime now, although I am writing the third Captain Random book at the moment, so we'll see how it goes. I'll tell you what I have been doing, and this will segue into something that we want to talk about. But I've been reading a lot of Twitter over the last 24 hours, should I say?
Yeah.
There's been quite a hubbub on Twitter with regards to a formerly well-respected convention franchise, let's say.
Yes, funnily enough, I went to bed last night just as I saw somebody... I saw this hashtag boycott Panopticon turn up, and I clicked on it, and there was probably only 3 posts under it.
All by the same person at the time.
Yes, and all by the same person. But sure enough, by the time I got up to have my breakfast this morning, it had taken on a bit of momentum, I would say.
Yeah, just a bit, hadn't it? What did you think? I mean, by the point that this has gone out, I'm presuming pretty much all of our listeners will have heard what's happened. But essentially, the Panopticon was a huge convention back in the day. I think it ran annually somewhere between 85 and I think 2003 was the last one. Anyway, from what I hear, 2003, the 40th anniversary, was a bit of a disaster. And over the last 16 years, it's laid dormant like some terrible fungal infection. And it's arisen over the last few months. And
it's like adamant. It's come back from the...
It was on Sunday the 20th, wasn't it? So it must
well, that was a mini version of it. They called it Panopticon Light. It was just like a kind of warm-up for the main one, which is coming next year in 2020.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so basically it's all blown up because of the... Is it the terms and conditions, Mark? There's a few questionable...
Yes, it is. It's in their terms and conditions. It's a load of... it's very bizarrely done. They've obviously gone for a jokey tone, and it's probably... It comes across to me a bit like... It's one of those things when you're sat in the pub with some mates and you're all a bit drunk, you say, you know what we should do, what would be funny, and you start making these jokes up and think, ah, that's great, yeah, that'd be really funny. Then you wake up the next day and you think, do you know what, those ideas are stupid. We definitely shouldn't ever put them out online.
Absolutely, yeah.
You're like that sort of Exorcist sketch you were thinking of, Mark.
Aww. I was sober then, damn it. That was Hayden's idea.
Yeah, I know what you mean. There's some badly... They're just not funny, though, are they?
No.
I don't understand who...
No, to make jokes about get a seat at the front so you can look up Katie or Fraser's skirt is a bit...
I mean, who wrote this press release? Bernard Manning?
I don't know.
I think it does come across strangely, but at the same time, I think it's been blown out of all proportion by people attacking it. It's almost as if they're trying to give the Me Too movement new impetus. So someone said something that was perhaps a little...
badly misjudged.
Misjudged. But the fact that someone might be going around the convention throwing custard pies into people's faces is surely a matter...
Oh, I don't like that laugh.
If if the matter of upskirting is a matter of appetite, then now it's... regard the Phantom Flanflinger as merely a matter of taste. In other words, if you don't like that sort of thing, don't go. Whereas I think possibly the upskirting thing is, I suspect it's misjudged. I don't think for one minute that they're actually suggesting that people should do that.
No, the thing is the phantom flinging thing whereby they say you can turn up in... It is a bit weird, though, because they say you can come in your cosplay, but you might get custard pies and water thrown over you unless you pay us £20. But then that's a joke, apparently. It just seems a bit odd.
Do you eat oysters?
When I have them, Master.
Do you eat snails?
No, Master.
Do you consider the eating of oysters to be moral and the eating of snails to be immoral?
No, Master.
Of course not. It is all a matter of taste, isn't it?
Yes, Master.
And taste is not the same as appetite, and therefore not a question of morals, is it?
It could be argued so, Master.
My taste includes both snails and oysters.
I wonder if what's happened is that a few people over the years have pissed off quite a lot of other people, and they've just unfortunately left themselves open for a bit of revenge, really.
I don't know if it sounds like they're trying to discourage cosplayers.
I think the thing is, I think they've badly misjudged the humour. And it's not, I mean, humour's things which are funny, and I just didn't even find that kind of thing funny. I mean, as someone speaking who's neither a classic, well, I'm not completely in the classic series camp, and I'm not completely in the new series camp. I don't...
No, you're a wilderness child.
It's just camp in general.
Just camp.
I'm camp wilderness over here. And the thing I find is that the way it's written is written in the kind of way which I do feel is kind of trying to get a bit of attention. I don't know, because I just don't understand why you'd put that out anyway. I completely get that there is a bit of an overreaction with this, but then you're asking for it when you've got a certain percentage of Doctor Who fandom on social media anyway, who will jump at the chance to get behind something and completely deride it as being absolutely disgusting. The problem I have is when you've got people who are influential within fandom, you know, the glitterati that I've called them in the past, coming out and saying one minute on social media, oh, you know, this is a load of overblown nonsense. And then all it takes is one other person of said glitterati to say, no, actually, no, this is terrible. And then they go, oh, yes, you're right, this is terrible. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, God, oh, outrage. And I just think, I'll make your mind up. You know, it's just... stupid.
Hayden there picking on the...
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can.
Don't worry, I won't broadcast that. I just wonder why people just can't get along.
We're in a society now where that kind of thing is going to spark people off, trigger people.
Yeah, I agree with Hayden on this. You should know when you make comments like that, and they're available over the internet, that they're going to be seen by people, and people are going to get in a fuss about it.
Yeah.
I don't believe that you can't know that these days.
No.
It's what happens. I don't think it's necessary that people are easier to be upset either. I think it's just the interconnectedness of everything. Back in the days before the internet, these incidents would happen, and you'd hear through them gradually word of mouth, blah-de-blah. And it'd take ages to get round, whereas now it's instant, isn't it? So as soon as one person picks up on it, and then they... I think it really took off this thing when it came to the attention of Paul Cornell, who tweeted extensively about it. And then obviously he's got thousands of followers.
Apparently. We've been told by other people.
Oh, yes.
Since he's blocked us. Blocked us on Twitter. I never said anything to him at all.
Did we say something about human nature? Because I really like human nature.
No. Well, I don't know.
No, I don't now. No, screw it now. But the way it's worded is almost to kind of say as well, you youngsters keep away, we only want a certain type of people here.
Yeah, they want the old time people. They even use that phrase.
Yeah.
We are from the old time. So it's a very strange way to market yourself, isn't it? I don't know.
Yeah.
But perhaps that's exactly what they want. It's just those sorts of people. But I mean, there's loads of using quotation marks in my fingers now, loads of gags in there. There's another bit about stewards saying, don't bother asking the stewards anything on the day because they don't know anything unless the only thing they will know is where the toilet is, etc., etc., things like that. And it's just a very odd tone to take. I think they started writing it with one or two gags in and then couldn't stop themselves, and it's ended up with this very strange tone for a piece that's supposed to be like rules for the convention.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know, man. I think there's an element of it which is possibly try to look for publicity, but then if that's the case, then I don't understand the tone, because Doctor Who's all about being inclusive, isn't it? It's about being an open church to everybody. And what this has initially said is, well, if you're not one of us, then don't come, because we don't want your kind here. So we're going to put these things in about, oh, well, we don't really like cosplayers, so we're going to make it difficult for them to dress up, and we'll go, oh, and then we'll put in a little joke about them. And there's just a very poorly judged sexual joke in there, which is actually... That's the bit that troubles me the most.
Yes,
because you'd think in the modern climate, and if you're putting this stuff out, and with social media as well, we've had the Me Too campaign, we've had all kinds of stuff come out in the last 10 years as well, with regards to sexual harassment and people in high places carrying out these atrocities. And I don't know whether you can leave this in, but there are people who are running this convention who are very high up themselves in the world of Doctor Who, and you just think that they'd be a bit more...
Does that mean they're very far up themselves?
Savvy about it. Yeah, yeah. Untouchable. There's an element of feeling untouchable.
We did see the first convention I went to, they actually had a panel, the 40th anniversary of Panopticon, and the organisers were on stage, and they did seem rather big-headed.
Oh,
and
then
there was a lot of... dick waving in with regards to their DWAS membership card numbers.
Hang on,
and stuff.
What was this?
This was the panel at the Capitol, 40 years of Panopticon, and it had several of the organisers from that there. And they all going, well, I was DWAS member number 14. Well, I was DWAS number 11. Oh, I was DWAS number 6.
Who cares?
Yeah, and they do swan about a lot.
But they are, I mean, this isn't for broadcast, but there are rumours which are all but confirmed to me that apparently at that 2003 one, there were...
Spins a web, any size, catches thieves, just like flies, look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud, he's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead. Hey there goes the Spider-Man. Chill of night at the scene of a crime, like a streak of light, he arrives just in time. Spider-Man, Spider-Man, friendly neighborhood Spider-Man, wealth and fame, he's ignored.
Yeah. Cruelly overlooked again. Yeah, I have to say the greatest horror for me that has come out of this entire affair is the hashtag that I spotted someone trying to get going, which was hashtag panopt out I can. Ouch.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Who was it that suggested that instead of boycott Panopticon, it should just have been Banopticon? Was that you?
No, that was some clever soul on Twitter who said that. I found that very funny. I've got to say, and we've got to invite him on at some point, but look at old Pip.
Who?
Pip Madeley.
Oh, right. You're going to say Paul Cornell, he can
Some of his reactional tweets to it have been absolutely fantastic. And on a chilly, wet and windy Monday morning, and with a terrible, you know, fandom divided yet again, good old Pip comes up with some fantastic... He had a tweeter that he put out not long ago, and it's and we now go live to the main stage at Panopticon. It's Steve Coogan's Tony Farino just chucking water over an interviewer on stage. And the Chuckle Brothers custard pieing someone on stage as well, and it's, you know, I suppose the best way around these things sometimes are the humour of the stupidity of it all, really, but there are certain aspects of it which I find deeply troubling. And actually, and their responses they've been responding to some people who have sort of confronted them on social media about their stance. And they've been very unapologetic in their way back. And
oh, they used the words, it was a disguised experiment, didn't they?
Yeah, yeah. It's something called a joke, i.e. a mildly outrageous statement intended to be taken humorously rather than seriously. Actually, it's a bit of disguised research to identify who does and doesn't find it funny. Wow. I mean, I'd like to do some disguised research. I mean, I might turn up in an anorak to their event and...
That's all we do on this podcast, isn't it?
Yeah, turn up in an anorak. Yeah, and you could actually, you know, I could turn up and actually work out whether it's a worthy convention or not. But, you know, there we are. Of course it's not going to be, because it if it decides to split fandom, then not worth our time, really.
No.
I don't want to give the impression that I don't turn my nose up at this sort of crass behaviour. It's just I really do have a lot more pressing things to get angry about. I don't find the upskirting joke funny. And all of this stuff that I've read about the forthcoming convention makes me think I probably wouldn't have found the event itself much fun. But I'm not sure that's sufficient reason to whip up a moral furore over it. Upskirting maybe, but custard pies?
Well, I mean, it was only a joke as well. It wasn't like they were going to carry it through. Yeah. So.
One person described the stuff about their own stewards probably not knowing what's going on as hateful. Oh, well. As for what Hayden says about an overreaction, it comes across to me as some very bored people hanging around online, we said hypocritically, looking for an opportunity to be outraged. What? An opportunity for outrage? Let me through. So I think too many Doctor Who fans can be like Esther Anson. You know, one minute they're swapping pictures of cock-shaped carrots, and the next minute it's, oh, the humanity! Or somebody please think of the children!
I was just going to say, just to add to that, that, yeah, it is an overreaction, but like I said previously, you wouldn't really necessarily write something like that if you weren't looking for the attention, though. Because, like you said, there are people who are quite triggered by this kind of thing online.
This is something that occurred to me today. I think that Hayden, Matt, and Alan are possibly unusual out of the seven hosts that have been of the Diddly Dum podcast in that you three of you came to us already steeped in Doctor Who fandom, didn't you? Whereas for the rest of us, certainly for Mark and myself, despite being lifelong lifelong lovers of Doctor Who.
Yeah. I knew it.
Our involvement in fandom was pretty much zero until we became involved in the podcast, wasn't it? Organised fandom, certainly. And certainly it was for me until I went online. And I wonder if as a result we have a slightly healthier attitude towards fandom. I mean, for instance, I'm always asking the others on this podcast, who's this Gary Levy you're talking about? Who is this Dame Andrew Beach? Oh, he edited a fanzine 30 years ago, Doc, which you didn't read and weren't even aware existed until 5 years ago. And maybe we, Mark and I, are able to take a more of a take-them-or-leave-them attitude to these movers and shakers in the realm of, I don't know. I think we need to recognise that if we, as fans, we want to climb onto a moral high horse, it's advisable to shut the stable door first. So I think that horse may have long bolted. And this is, after all, the same fandom, many of whose members 6 years ago, when the JNT book came out, were going out of their way to find excuses for two men in their late 30s, early 40s, taking sexual advantage of fans who weren't even old enough to vote. If it had been a few years later, it wouldn't have been illegal. No, but it would still have been creepy and abusive and exploitative. And those same people are now clutching their pearls over a foolishly crass upskirting joke. It just seems a bit,
Well, absolutely. Well, I think the likes of myself, Alan and Matt, were sort of more in the know of these people and these, you know, different organisations setting up the conventions, mainly because we were helping out with them. But I mean, I know on my account, I was helping out with the conventions and other different events, purely really just for an in the vain hope that one day I might end up actually working on the show. However, I'm now much older and a lot less naive to go along to these things and actually expect a thing like that, you know, so positively to happen.
I mean, I'm quite prepared to accept that it's possible that my attitude, because of that, is actually not one of, worldly wise, I can just wave this away, but just sort of naivety. So I don't actually, I do give certain people the benefit of the doubt, so if I knew more about them, I possibly wouldn't.
Yeah.
And what I have heard about some of these people has been bad enough. Anyway, faithless listeners, faithless few, today is, of course, the 31st of October, Halloween, and the date has no other significance whatsoever. And we thought we'd celebrate Halloween this year by looking into scary moments in Doctor Who. And so we have asked friends of the show, or at least those of us still on speaking terms with us, to send in on social media their scariest moments from experiencing Doctor Who over the years. And Hayden, Mark and I have picked our own top five scariest moments and our scariest moments of all.
Mm. And I've been trying to think of categories of horror as well and see. And also I wanted to talk about a type of horror that I do find particularly disturbing and particularly bothered me as a kid.
Well, indeed. Perhaps we could start by looking at the sort of things which did memorably scare us as children. Mark, would you like to kick us off? We were chatting the other day, weren't we, about the things that used to keep us scared, even when we were tucked up in bed. What was the story that scared you so much that you didn't dare leave the safety of your bed, even for the most urgent of reasons?
The Talons of Weng Chiang, almost purely because of the character of Mr. Sin, which absolutely terrified me when I was little. Especially that scene where he's got his knife out and he comes in through the door. There was a chest in my room as well. And obviously...
like the linen basket.
Yeah, like the linen basket. So I can remember laying in my bed and thinking, oh my God, I should have checked that before I got into bed. I'm just laid there staring at the linen basket all night. I mean, I was only about... been about five, I guess.
Wow. Of course, I used to do that at that age. But I'd lie in bed and my parents would probably leave the light on the landing, but with my door half closed, so there was light coming on from under the door. And I'd lie in bed and I'd see the light throwing a shadow of my jumper over the back of a chair on the wall, and it looks like, oh, that looks like a dinosaur's head. If I woke up in the middle of the night and suddenly saw that, a dinosaur's head, I might have a heart attack and die. So I used to actually get out of bed and straighten the jumper so it wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
I'd be doing this regularly several nights. But Mr. Sin was well scary. Far scarier than Magnus Greel.
Yeah, I mean, there was that moment when his mask came off, which was quite horrific. But it's just that. It's like his strange pig noises as well. Oh, I don't know what I should say. I think it was after Talons one night that I didn't want to get out of bed and go to the toilet, so I used a plastic boat next to my bed.
Oh.
But I got told off by my mum in the morning.
Like his boaty McBoat face, I hold you. Well, was this because you were too scared to go out of your room?
Yes, too scared to go out of your room.
One of the Kelly girls said to her mum about two Doctor Who's is too much.
She was having difficulty getting to sleep, and she went up and said, why aren't you asleep yet? And she said, I think two Doctor Who episodes might be too much to think about.
I suppose it depends whose era it is, isn't it?
It was the Christopher Eccleston, so yeah.
I've actually found compiling this list quite difficult because, unlike yourselves, I didn't grow up with the TV series the time. Yeah, but I was a coward when it came to other things. So, for example, I went a very brief period being scared of the single Ghost Town by The Specials. Mainly for the reason that...
Is it the... Oh!
It was the trumpeted... The... That bit. Because it...
Oh, yes, I know, yeah.
Because I'd listened to it in an old farmhouse that my friend grew up in. And he had the single on vinyl, and the front cover freaked me out a little bit because it was two skeletons slumped at a piano. And he was always telling me ghost stories about this house. He was always saying about how on the same day every single month, the calendar would fall off the wall and that kind of thing. And it was all very chilling. So I started listening to this song, which is all very... This town is coming like a ghost town. Thinking that they're zombies or something like that. So anyway, there was that. And then this stayed with me for a little while, actually. I was terrified of old TV commercials for a while. What a weird, weird, weird child I was. But there were two in particular, and they were on my grandfather's old tapes. I've spoken on here before and also on other podcasts about my love of Bond, and my grandfather used to lend me his James Bond films that he taped off like ITV in the 80s. So you'd be watching, I don't know, say for example Moonraker, and all of a sudden you'd have an advert like David Bailey's Greenpeace advert, which I'm not sure whether you two would have grown up watching this or seen it at all, but it was called Dumb Animals, and it's women walking up and down a catwalk,
and as supermodels,
that's it, yeah,
in furs,
and as they turn around blood comes up, and then you hear horrible like chimp noises, and it was just so disturbing and discombobulating. I remember I had a sleepless night after seeing that once.
You didn't wee in a boat though.
And the other one was much older, but this turned up on an old video, and I can't for the life of me, I don't think this was shown in the 80s. I tried to find out a little bit more information about it, but the one that really got me as well was The Spirit of Dark and Lonely Water, which was a public information film.
Yes.
For all of you outside of the UK.
Yeah, it's a 70s public information film.
Yeah, and it's basically, it's Death, voiced by Donald Pleasance, commentating on children either playing on like a rusty old car tip or in a very deep lake, where he's saying stuff like, "This branch is weak, rotten, it'll never hold his weight." And it's just, you know, it's, and the "I'll be back" at the end of it too was spine-chilling. So I found those things terrifying.
I am the spirit of dark and lonely water, ready to trap the unwary, the show-off, the fool. And this is the kind of place you'd expect to find me. But no one expects to find me here. It seems too ordinary. But that pool is deep. The boy is showing off. The bank is slippery. The show-offs are easy. But the unwary ones are easier still. This branch is weak, rotten. It'll never take his weight. Only a fool would ignore this. But there's one born every minute. Under the water there are traps, old cars, bedsteads, weeds, hidden depths. It's the perfect place for an accident.
Oh, look, there's someone in the water. Quick, use that big stick to get him out.
Sensible children, I have no power over them.
Oi, mate, that's a stupid place to swim. Hey, go over and get that thing to wrap him in. You don't have to feel cold, mate. How long was you in there?
I'll be back.
And the voices in old this sounds strange, but the voiceover in the Yellow Pages ad, which was really deep, in the good old Yellow Pages, that thing as well, I found quite unnerving. And it all came back to me when I was 15 year old. We did advertising in my media studies class, and I had to watch all of these adverts again. And, they sent a shiver up my spine then as well.
Good old Yellow Pages.
There was another one which I'll just quickly talk about, which was the Tango ads in the 90s.
What, with the fat, bald, orange guy?
Yeah, well, it wasn't that one. There was one where a man takes a drink of Tango and his head blows off.
Whoa, big Tango! Is that one?
His head explodes.
Oh, yes.
Pops off his shoulders. And it looked naff, it looked stupid, but it was unsettling, I'd say.
This must be the...
No!
The tongue traumatizing hint of real oranges in Tango!
No!
Johnny, hold my hand.
Whoa! He might need a new pair of corduroys after that, Ralph. Stonking.
You know where you've been tangoed.
Do you remember a tango ad where they were worshipping Gotan? And they were chanting, go tan, go tango, tango.
No,
and there was a phone number at the end. And I rang the phone number up and left my address. And they sent me a mini Gotan effigy, which is like a kind of orange boggle-eyed morph type.
Oh, that one. Yes, I remember that now. Figure. Yes, I'm surprised they didn't get sued for that.
Yeah, so I've got one of those somewhere.
Oh, lordy.
To get your tango doll, call this number now.
Yeah, so anyway, so this is a very long-winded way of me getting around to it. So Doctor Who, when I watched it, I was sort of already in the knowledge that it was a show that was scary, but it wasn't so... I think because that amount of time had been so far removed from me, I didn't find it that scary. So it's difficult to say. So what I thought I'd choose instead were moments which I found either unpleasant, unnerving, or just creepy.
So basically, you were fine watching the BBC. It was only when you went on to ITV and in between programmes that you got distressed.
Yeah, it was. And I was getting distressed by silly things. Like I said, when we did this ad campaign thing at school in media studies, they were showing old adverts from like the 50s as well. And there was a Swan advert with a man who looked a bit like Frank Sinatra.
They were selling Swans in the 50s.
Was it Swan? It was cigarette.
Swan Vestas?
No, Swan do make smoking.
Hang on a minute. I'm just going to close things. The blind. Hang on a minute.
I'm just going to lock the door.
I don't like looking out into the blackness while I'm talking about things like this. No, it was... Okay, here, let me just sit down and I'll get comfy again. And then the voiceover would be something like, "You're never alone with Swan." Like that. And it was just...
That's just sad. Oh, I must get myself a Swan. I'm so lonely.
And they were just a bit creepy.
We're talking about cigarettes.
Hmm.
"You're never alone with a strand." Swan.
"You're never alone with a strand. The cigarette of the moment. Strand, the new tipped cigarette. Wonderful value at 3 and 2 pence for 20.
"You're never alone with a swan."
And there was an... Oh, flipping heck. There was another one where... because we were watching all these old things. There's another one with Tony Hancock about eggs. And that was fine. But the woman in that was, I found, a bit sinister. I had to leave the room at one point. It was just a bit sort of unnerving and a bit weird. And I don't know. Yeah, very odd.
You're having some sort of strange flashbacks.
I am a bit, actually. It is strange. Yeah, I am having a bit of a...
I mean, I think the thing for you, Hayden, was even if you were relatively young watching your Doctor Who DVDs or videos...
DVDs? Young man.
8 tracks.
Yeah. When you were sitting there, you're in control of the programme. You could pause it, stop it. You could take the tape out, smash it to pieces and go and bury it in a pit in the garden if you wanted to.
Many a time.
Whereas for me and Doc, when we were watching as kids, as far as we were concerned, that was the only time that episode was ever going to be shown. So we had to sit there and sit through it, even if it terrified us, because you didn't want to miss it. You didn't want to be going into school. You didn't want to not know what had happened in the rest of the episode. So you had to. Whereas like for you, you can either pause, fast forward, whatever. You were in control, whereas I guess we weren't when we were watching it on broadcast. We didn't have control of it. You end up covering your face with a cushion.
I'll tell you what, I mean, that's a very salient point, because there is one that I want to talk about, which I did want to fast forward through because it unsettled me a little bit. And it was one of those few occasions where I really did think, ooh, no, hang on.
I don't feel safe now. So yeah, now, but like I said, there's only really one occasion.
You know that really bad cliffhanger in Death of the Daleks where they reach the checkered floor and the doctor says stop?
Yes. Yeah.
Did you say to your mum, Hayden, oh, I don't understand, that doesn't work, and she's just saying, hang on, love, I'm just changing the reel.
Oh, so many times, so many times.
Right, let's go through all the eras. Let's have a look at season one, then. I think the first really memorable scary scene for me is the end of episode one of The Daleks, where Barbara's backing away. And possibly it's, we don't know, if we'd been kids in this time, it might have terrified us. But I think perhaps it's more a case that I'm thinking, oh, that's a well-done scene, isn't it? Rather than thinking, oh, I'm terrified by it.
Yeah, well, obviously none of us were watching it at the time, was it? So this is something that we, with these ones, I guess we're in the same boat as Hayden in that we've watched them when we're older.
Mm.
But yeah, you'd say that was probably the first moment of horror, wasn't it? It certainly had a massive effect. It's you look back on, you know, it was a great introduction for the Daleks, wasn't it? It was mysterious. Mm. Barbara was horrified. Nobody, you know, this was it was still a relatively new show. Nobody knew quite where it was going, so... where am I going? I tell you one thing, I do. One of the first bits that creeped me out was in The Unearthly Child, the first episode, when they're in the junkyard and there's that horrible dummy with its.
Oh, like, with its sunken face.
Yeah! That dummy. There's a dummy in the junkyard and the doctor's sort of creeping around behind the scenes. And that's, I find that junkyard quite creepy, but yeah, it's not really horror, I suppose.
Yeah, but it doesn't have to be horror to make you jump. I mean, one of the oldest techniques in the book when it comes to horror is a very, almost a sort of kind of lazy interpretation of a scare, I suppose, where you've got just something going blah like that, you know, it's a natural reaction for you. To react to that by going, ah, like that, because it's your body recoiling.
Mm.
But that's not really horror. That's just, like I said, a natural reaction. Mm. Yeah, the sunken face. I mean, actually, there is something to be said about the actual theme tune of the show. Because there was a vote, I remember, do you remember back in the noughties where Channel 4 did the top 100 blah 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 almost every single week, didn't they?
Yeah.
In 2004, they did the top 100 scary moments, and Doctor Who was in that twice. One of them was the Daleks, and the other one was the actual theme tune.
Oh, right.
Mm.
Yes.
Perhaps a different type of horror. Is it Edge of Destruction where Susan attacks Barbara with the scissors?
Yeah, more psychological
horror.
Now,
I think that could be deeply disturbing, that, for a child.
Mm-hmm.
Possibly not so much because it's only the third story. You've not got to know the four of them that well yet.
Well, I was going to say that actually comes under, that's psychological, and also specifically it's almost like possession, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is something that will crop up repeatedly for me throughout this discussion. It's someone that looks familiar, but they're behaving in a completely alien manner. And yeah, I always find that terrifying. Well, which I'll go into more detail later.
Yeah, I think the theme tune in itself can be quite eerie. And I think seeing the swirls, you know, the black and white swirls for the very first time was probably because it was so surreal and strange, would have been quite scary.
Yes.
So we've got a very wide range of stories that we can talk about here. But I just think that the actual theme tune itself, even though...
It's the aesthetic that is unsettling.
Yes. Yes, it is. Yes.
And striking, which is probably why the programme's such a success.
Mm.
Yeah, to be honest, you say there's a lot in this era. I'm not sure there's an awful lot of horror as such, is there? There's not masses of it. Possibly the Censorites. There's that cliffhanger to part one again, isn't there? Where the Censorite looks particularly creepy. And then he doesn't look as creepy when they do the start of part two, do they? It's a slightly different mask, I think. But there's something really strange and unnerving about that weird alien face peering in through the window at the end of episode one.
But I think for me, the thing that really sells it is the scream from Jacqueline Pierce. It's a real blood-curdling scream. And that's the thing that makes that moment quite terrifying. But something which can scare, and I think this is what Doctor Who's always been very good at doing, is taking an everyday thing and making it sinister, or making it weird, making it strange. So, shop window dummies, for example. Something that we see every single day. Statues. Stephen Moffat had a penchant for, you know, shadows. You know, if you stand in the shadows, you'll be eaten, you'll be stripped. Like piranhas of the air.
Again, we are coming from it from the perspective of people looking at it. I wouldn't have seen any of this stuff until I was in my mid-20s.
Yeah.
On broadcast. Actually, I mean, the Dalek Invasion of Earth, the concept of the Robo-Men is pretty horrible. And again, that's a bit like that kind of thing which I said about the possession. I think it's the losing of one's self, isn't it? It's the erasure of one's personality, if you're lucky enough to have one. And then I think that's what's... I mean, it's a disturbing concept.
Well, the first time you meet the Robo-Men, you have one of them committing suicide on screen.
Well, yes. Yeah, I mean, it's quite dark, isn't it? It's quite a dark invention.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's something to be said as well. I know we've gone the whole way through the Hartnell era here, but more of a whistle-stop tour of creepy moments. But even that first time that the Cybermen turn up as well is slightly creepy. I remember watching that on Cybermen early years video. You know, these vacuous eyes, but the hands are human. Where everything else is looking... Yeah.
And those incredibly bizarre voices. Although, unfortunately, my... I don't mean to mention Pip Madeley again, but whenever I see them now, I can't help imagining them singing a song. He's done a very funny video, Pip Madeley, and it's totally removed any... I can't take them on Dacian Cybermen seriously now, I'm afraid.
I mean, there are some truly horrific concepts in the first Doctor's era. I mean, Galaxy 4, the concept of a society where the chaps aren't in charge?
Twisted mind thought that up.
Hashtag bang Optican.
I've been on Twitter. I know what the ladies plan to do to us if they get in charge.
What's that?
Hashtag boycott equality. It's not a particularly a full era, is it?
No, not really. Like I say, it's more in the aesthetic of it, and that might be just because we're looking at it from our point in time. What about Master Clan? Is that...
Nothing from that really gets me.
No, I mean, there's the ageing process at the end, which I imagine was probably pretty horrific at the time.
And there's Katarina going out of the airlock, but unfortunately we don't really care about either of them, do we?
Oh, you don't care about Sarah Kingdom aging to death?
No, I care about her, but it's not having someone I care about.
Oh, I don't know. Let's move on.
It's possibly the scariest look of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
There's ever been in the 10th Planet, the fabric ones.
Mm. Yeah.
Totally destroyed for me by now by the seeing one of them smoking a fag in an adventure in space and time.
Yeah.
Can't get that out of my mind now. So, should we move on to the, and totally uncommented on by any of our listeners, by the way, the Hartnell era.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, looking at their list of the stories they've mentioned, I think they're probably a lot of them are of our generation.
Yes.
Or maybe people old enough to be children while this stuff was on, don't actually know how to use the internet.
Oh, dear, oh dear. I thought you were going to say are in a home.
I thought you could say that listening to the Blue Box podcast. Yeah, I mean, the Second Doctor as well, the Second Doctor era, I don't think... I mean, for me, a couple of things that come to mind. They're both from stories that don't actually exist anymore. When watching Padmasambhava from The Abominable Snowmen, I find quite scary because of his voice and his weird face, having seen the reconstruction.
Yeah.
Did I pronounce that right, Padmasambhava?
You have indeed.
Well, I was just going to say, it's very brave, Mark, because that's how I've always assumed it would be pronounced, but I never dare to do it myself. Right, because okay. I got it wrong. that's an interesting point, isn't it? Because I wonder if, because I wasn't what certainly Mark and I weren't watching any of the Help Me There and we were impressionable kids, but we probably were reading the Target books, weren't we?
Hmm.
So is there any stuff in there that?
Well, I don't know about you, but once again, this is something which was, I think, possibly seemed a little more unsettling because they were cut so quickly together, and also because the viewer was told that they were censored, which means like, oh, this is almost forbidden stuff. And that's the censor clips that were in the Lost in Time DVD and previously released on the Ice Warriors collection in the late 90s. Seeing, I can't remember his name now, but the guy from the Wheeling Space getting burnt up alive and screaming in horror. And then, I think, is it Captain Pike in The Smugglers stabbing Jamaica as well? And all these horrific moments were all very quickly spliced together. But there's one that really sticks out for me with the Troughton era, and that's the Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill sequence from
yes.
Heroes from the Deep.
Yeah, absolutely. Even watching it now, I watched it a couple of days ago, that clip, actually.
What, the Fury from the Deep? You watched that?
What, where they just open their mouths and
yeah,
scream?
Well, it's the way they walk in and their expressions on their face.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know if they've got some weird sort of makeup on their lips as well, haven't they? I'm thinking. But, yeah, and the way they walk up and she's talking to them, she looks... Her performance is really good because, again, like episode one of The Dalek, she seems terrified. And those two actors are so brilliantly cast. Honestly, it's just, even now, just photographs of, I can't remember which one's which. The tall one, when he's opening his mouth, it's just...
Which one is this, Fury from the Deep?
Yes, this is Fury
from
the Deep.
I'm not that familiar with it, unfortunately.
Again, this is another one I've watched the reconstruction of, but this is one of the surviving bits of footage. I still find it deeply disturbing.
It's his eyes. It's his eyes that bulge out of his mouth as that sound comes in. It's truly horrific. And to be honest, I'm surprised they even got it past the censors of the BBC to get that on, you know.
Yeah, I do genuinely, this probably would be one of my top scenes, I think, because it's, I think there's also, there's that, again, it's that thing that they look like humans and they come in, but their entire behaviour, the way they move, their almost choreography, if you like, is just so alien and other that it's almost as if you were in that room with them, you just feel, even just watching it, they just emit otherness.
Mm.
And it's that that's just, but they're just supposed to, they look like a couple of maintenance men, don't they?
Yeah, they look almost comedic, don't they? Because one's very tall and thin, the other one's very small and fat.
Yes.
There's another scene in this as well, which was the moment where the weed creature grabs the man and drags him under the bubbles.
Mm.
And the camera focuses on the torch that he leaves there as his hand sort of slipping away from the bank side. And that's truly terrifying as well, actually.
Oh, God, yes. And again, there's possession in this, isn't there? Because there's that scene of the people get possessed and they go and walk into the sea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I look forward to seeing... This is one... Are they doing this or are they doing the faceless one?
It's the faceless ones they're doing next. Yeah,
faceless ones, yeah.
Unless you're really Mark from the future, in which case... Thanks for the heads up, man.
No, well, eventually they'll get around to it, hopefully. I'd love to see Fury from the Deep. It just...
I would.
Looks terrifying.
Yeah.
I must restart my watching through series. I got stalled at...
Massacre.
Massacre. And what's going on with that? I didn't know that. Fury from the Deep, the guy who directed that, Hugh David, was the husband of Wendy Williams, who played Vyra in The Ark in Space.
Oh, God.
I didn't know that.
Wow. Oh, well, and that's another one which we'll be coming to, won't we? We'll be stopping off at.
Talking of Susan attacking Barbara with the scissors, I think the Cyberman hairdressing scene in Wheeling Space with Zoe isn't quite as... scary as that one.
Snip, snip.
No, definitely not. But I want to talk about my main pick for the Troughton era, and that is...
Oh, right.
That is the Web of Fear.
Ah, well...
How could we have guessed?
They managed to sort the Yetis out for this one, didn't they?
They did indeed. Well, again, this was just something which, after reading the book and getting a real claustrophobic feel from the book for years, when I first saw the first episode, it was shown on the Lost in Time DVD, and not long afterwards was shown on BBC Four as well. As, and I can't remember, I think there was a night about the British transport system, I think it was, and so they decided to show that first episode. That first episode is fantastic. Absolutely brilliant. Mm. The eeriness of the music in Julius Silverstein's, in his museum.
Mm.
But the bit when Professor Travers and Anne Travers leave the room, that scene becomes instantly scarier. And it gets worse as he's blowing out the candles and and it's all black and white and shadows. And, you know, it's truly, it's terrifying.
Yeah, it looks like, sorry, who directed that? Was that a Canfield?
That was Douglas Canfield, yes.
Yeah, you can tell Douglas Canfield's enjoying himself playing with the kind of like making his own little mini horror movie intro almost, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, with the music building up and the crushing moment, and even the classic old movie trope of the clip of, you know, you've got the Yeti bashing Silverstein to death, but there's a cut to Jamie just sort of tapping on the TARDIS. You get that quite a lot in horror films. You get a moment where someone swings an axe, and then it will cut to someone slicing through a loaf, like a bread loaf or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, chopping a lettuce up, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so it's that, and it's also the moments on film in the underground too, and that incessant kind of music going on in the background as well. The echoes around the underground. Again, the familiarity of seeing a world that we see every single day,
yes,
changed and different and eerie and spooky, because the underground is never empty, but it is here.
Yeah. And it's become a trap as well, hasn't it?
It becomes
a base under, you know, it becomes a base under siege, doesn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah, it's that claustrophobia of somewhere that's normally normal and bright and everyday, and suddenly, it's like you said, it's the everyday. It's the same thing as with Quill and Oak. It's what should be normal, but it's...
It's warped. It's warped, yes. Isn't it? And it's different. It's like looking through a black mirror. Yeah, it's truly... Yeah, truly unsettling stuff.
Did you used to wake up screaming in the middle of the night, Hayden, having dreamed of hordes of librarians with late return slips attacking you?
Oh, if only.
Oh, what was it? The Telltale Target novel?
Yes. Well, remember, chaps, this is the only Doctor Who story which was preceded with a trailer from the Doctor himself saying, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I was so happy that story came back.
So, where are we?
I've got something to say about the invasion as well. There's the moment, the iconic moment of the Cybermen coming out of the sewers. It's a fantastic moment, a brilliant moment of action, of direction and tension. However, the bit that really sells it for me is Derek Sherwin's cameo of him lying face down on the steering wheel with his eyes open.
Oh, right,
In the build-up to that scene. That's fairly creepy.
Again, it's set in present day as well, isn't it? So... I think that adds...
Exactly.
Contemporaneous stories can add a certain element of extra fear to them.
Well, it's like going back to Web of Fear. It's the old adage about finding a Yeti sitting on the loo in Tooting, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. Well, yeah, exactly. It's that courtesy of John Pertwee.
So that brings us up to the end of the Troughton era. Now, here we are. This is some decent stuff now. Pertwee era, Spearhead from Space. That jerky Orton in his blue overalls, stalking it. Oh, scenes that always scare me. There was one in Inspector Morse, what am I thinking of, Endeavour, as I was watching recently, is, you know, where you unzip a triangular tent and you see the back wall of it has been slashed to pieces.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that sort of thing always hits me. And with the start of the Pertwee era, we get the first vote from one of our listeners. Sir Fearfrom at Far From All Over on Twitter says his scariest moment was absolutely Spearhead from Space. All of it is bloody terrifying. And he's absolutely right, because this is one of the first of my... top five in Spearhead from Space is the shop dummies.
Ah.
Just breaking. We don't actually see them breaking the glass, do we?
No.
But that's amazing, isn't it? I think we imagine that we do, don't we?
Mm.
Because, and which shows how powerful it is. But just those. I mean, obviously, the faces look scary themselves. They don't look like those fairly calm, serene faces that mannequins tend to have in shop windows. They look pretty horrific. Quite, who was buying those smoking jackets? I don't know.
No, well, you can tell they hadn't dressed themselves.
And just shooting people down in a... Again, this is, you know what we're saying about the Yeti on the loo and tooting, shooting people down in a bus queue.
Yeah. Brutal, isn't it?
I sometimes feel like that in the morning when I get to the bus queue and I'm waiting there for 5 minutes on my own, and then suddenly a pair of school children turn up, stand at the front and get on the bus in front of me.
Do you start praying for autons?
Salurians.
Oh, yes.
It's interesting because particularly with what Mark and I have been doing recently, let me rephrase that, particularly with what Mark and I have been watching recently with the survivors. That, what really scares me in the Salurians is the whole, the guy travels to London.
Oh, Masters, yeah.
Travels to London and starts, the ticket collector at the barrier gets the plague off him. And then so-and-so, that really, really scares me, even at my advanced age.
Yeah, like you say, it's very similar to the start of Survivors, isn't it? Especially those long shots with loads of people just dropping down at the station.
Mm.
And the effect the plague has as well, when you see it on... Oh, what's his...
Dr. Lawrence.
When you see Dr. Lawrence's face falling apart. And
when it's all rotting and it's...
His hair's all over the place,
Something that I find scary on that is, you know when the doctor visits Dr. Quinn in his cottage, Fulton Mackay, and we know that he's keeping... Do we know at that stage he's keeping one of the Salurians in his barn or something? Or may I only know that because I've read the novelisation? And he clearly thinks, I can reason with this creature or something, and we know that he's only going to end up getting topped by him.
Mm. The way they hide the appearance of the Salurians for so long works really well to build up. It's difficult, isn't it, for us? Because obviously we've grown up seeing pictures of them in Doctor Who magazine and stuff long before we got a chance to actually watch them. Or, well, certainly for me anyway.
You take that back, please, Mark. I've never grown up and I never will.
Long before we've got a chance to... long before we got a chance to watch them. We were already really familiar with them. Ambassadors, I find... there is something quite creepy about those guys walking around in the spacesuits, and that's quite a scary cliffhanger with the doctor with one of the astronaut suits moving up behind him and reaching out to touch him, and you know it's going to kill him.
It's one of those that doesn't interest me, so I've watched it so few times that I can't think of scenes, you know, automatically.
It's a story I'm rather fond of, actually. I like Ambassadors of Death. I mean, the Pertwee era is where the horror really started getting going, didn't it? As we know it properly in Doctor Who, I think.
Yes, yeah. Isn't colour's got anything to do with that?
I was just about to say that. Has it got anything to do with colour? I mean, I don't know, because as we've already said, there's an unsettling aesthetic in its own way to black and white and an eeriness and a creepiness. Maybe with the Third Doctor era, it's starting and the colour coming on. Maybe it's just that things are a little bit more visceral. Looking a little bit gorier looking.
Yeah, possibly. We've also, in quick succession, reached our second vote, which is from a friend of the show himself, David Kitchen, at DK Wedgetail on Twitter. In fact, a typical politico, he's voted for three. Oh no, two. He's voted for Benton being turned into a Primord in Inferno.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Slowly being turned into something inhuman whilst helpless to stop it is chilling. Yes, that's true. Yeah.
Again, I'll go, that's one of my ultimate fears, the loss of self.
The loss of control, yeah.
Yeah.
Over your own...
Mm.
Yeah, very much so.
Can I just say, in Inferno, one of the bits I don't like is the guy who doesn't go full Primord, but he just goes sort of green.
Full Primord.
Yeah, he doesn't go full primordial. He's the guy who goes greeny blue colour.
Yeah,
gets chased up on top of the gasometer.
Hmm.
I find that guy really creepy.
Inferno. So the next one is... Oh!
Can I just say, I've never found this next one disturbing at all. Never found it disturbing.
What, Terror of the Autons? You're joking! Are you insane?
Possibly, Doc. Possibly.
I found it terrifying, even just reading the bleeding novelisation.
The only bit that I found possibly a little unsettling... By the way, I was in my 20s when I saw Terror of the Autons for the first time, so that may be why. But the actual stunt made me ooh and ah more than the creepy visuality of it, and that's the Auton policeman getting run off the cliff. And then falling down the cliff and then just advancing back up again.
Is that scary though or impressive?
That was more... Well, this is what I'm saying, is it could be perceived as terrifying because it's... You'd think being hit by a car and falling off the edge of a cliff would be enough to kill this thing. But no, it keeps going. And it's coming back up the cliff straight after.
And a bit less cheek, please, Hayden.
What?
I too was in my 20s the first time I saw this.
In 1971.
But you've got the black plastic sofa swallowing people, haven't you?
Mm.
You've got the giant carnival head men, which I find absolutely scary. You've got the little doll that on the radiator.
Well, the thing is, this is Robert Holmes, isn't it? You can tell this is Robert Holmes trying to scare the hell out of kids. I think he's literally entertaining himself by trying to scare the kids as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, was this the first public protest we got against scariness in Doctor Who, where the police famously asked them not to present the police as scary to children?
Yeah, because when that policeman's face comes off and he's revealed to be an Auton, because it takes away, the security that the figure of a police officer is supposed to provide for the public.
Oh, and the thing that really scared me in the books, genuinely, I mentioned this before, but I am very, very mildly, not that it actually affects my life at all, claustrophobic. And I don't know if there's links into this, but, you know, the auto jet, the plastic daffodil spraying plastic on your face so you can't breathe.
Mm.
I mean, I know some people actually put that on their Tinder profile, don't they? But... I thought, oh, that's really scary, that. Never actually dreamt of being strangled by a telephone cord, so,
Pertwee's gurning face does a lot to disarm that bit. Stops that from being terrifying.
See, so it didn't put off...
Spider-Man, friendly neighbourhood Spider-Man.
Oh, dear.
I probably can't put that in, can you?
We've come to another vote from one of our listeners, which is from Ham-Fisted Bap Vendor on Twitter. Scariest moment? My childhood memory of a Dalek threatening Pertwee's doctor while he's under the hallucinatory influence of the Keller machine. A memory now woefully and cruelly dashed by a recent and very belated DVD viewing. Oh, hang on. He then sends a second... that's rather Galaxy 4 of me, isn't it? Could well be a lady. Ham-Fisted Bat Vendor then sends... in fact, as the first Ham-Fisted Bat Vendor was Joe Grant, I think we should... maybe not. Ham-Fisted Bat Vendor then goes on in a later tweet to say, well, I'll eat my hat if I had one. But I've just got to episode 5 of Mind of Evil and my missing Dalek appears after all when Pertwee throws the coil around the machine. The memory didn't quite cheat, albeit my once terrifying Dalek has been reduced to a blink and you'll miss it caption. I would have thought that more people would find that scary, because it's almost set up to be deliberately, you know, it's like mind, not necessarily body horror, but mind horror, isn't it?
Yes. I do love Mind of Evil, but I don't find it particularly frightening. I find it very gritty.
I find Mind of Evil quite outrageous in a way. You know where they're in the main hall of the prison and the doctor's about to be killed and then the brigadier shoots whoever's about going to kill him. And instead of saying thank you, the doctor does his sort of
No. Oof, perhaps you could try to stop appearing just in the nick of time. I was the Brigadier. If I hadn't just emptied my magazine into a baddie, I'd have been seriously tempted to shoot the Doctor just knowing he couldn't die, just to show him.
Yeah, I think it's... I think considering it's supposed to be a story based on psychological terror that's so great that it can kill people, I find it strangely unfrightening story, but then that's probably because I can still imagine that dragon waddling around.
Colony in Space, I didn't find particularly scary. I did find the novelisation, the Doomsday Machine, scary. That's one of the ones where I always think of as one of my very early novelisations I had. I can still remember was it purplish or just a brown cover? I can't remember. But the scary bit was the idea of, all these colonists being in domes well away, miles away from the main dome, and being attacked by primitives or the IMC robots. That scared me to death, that.
Mm.
Demons?
Well, the Demons is obviously like a mini horror film, isn't it, really?
Yes, I suppose so.
But it's
not, very Hammer horror-ish in a way.
It's very Hammer horror-ish. It's again, it's something that never particularly scared me. I'd say the next part that I've particularly bothered me, but it's probably the Sea Devils with the... especially when they're cutting through the side of the ship, that always... I seem to remember seeing a repeat of it when I was... I don't know how old I was.
Well, I've always thought the Sea Devils was the first one I can remember watching, but then I don't remember anything in between until we got to Planet of the Daleks. So I'm wondering if I saw... From Planet of the Daleks onwards, I can remember watching most of it. So I'm wondering if I saw one of those repeats, in the summer holidays with the Sea Devils.
Mm. I was going to say, yeah, Planet of the Daleks is one where I remember the novelisation, which terrified me. It's the bit where Joe's trapped on the shuttle and the invisible whatever it is, which I didn't know at the time,
comes in
and starts picking stuff up, moving stuff around. And that used to scare the crap out of me when I read it in the Target novel.
You've got body horror again, haven't you, with that plant has squirted on her arm?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. And I was absolutely terrified that when she and, was it Lartep, went on their long trek searching for the bombs that they might not find. Oh, I'll come with you. Thanks. Here they are. But just before we do get to Sea Devils, we have M.A.W. Holmes on Twitter has voted for Curse of Peladon. Curse comes from a monster, doesn't it?
Yes, yes, yes.
I always remember that it's alphabetical, like the two seeds ones. Arcturus was disturbing. Head, glass bubble, fluids, voice. That was troubling. Mutants or time monster? Benton naked from behind? Is that horrifying for you, Hayden?
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I still can't look John Levine in the face. Getting onto the Green Death, the only part of that I found a little unnerving was John Scott Martin's minor at the start when he's pulled the lever for the horn to blow, for the warning, and the camera pans down from his green pulsating skin on his hand to his face and is completely consumed by this green pulsing power.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, body horror is one of Doctor Who's favourite types of horror, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially in the 70s, I would say.
Yeah. Yeah. That and insects, I'd say, went hand in hand, didn't they?
M.A.W. Holmes does also mention that maggot crawling along the floor behind Joe's back as she worked. That was troubling. Though, yes, those maggots were scary. It's a pity that the giant fly was much scarier in the novelisation than on the TV.
Yeah, I think the realisation of the maggots, the model maggots that they made with the fox skulls, look genuinely horrific.
Invasion of the Dinosaurs is perhaps the anti-scary story. The monsters which make you laugh rather than being scary, which is appalling, and it's such a belting story.
Of course, there's always Tony Cornter's horror when he realises that he happens to...
I've sold my house!
Yeah, he's indulges... Oh no! The horror! After he spent all that time thinking it through as well. That's psychological horror, I'd say.
I suppose one of the next big ones that we should talk about is the is Planet of the Spiders.
Well, yeah, big creepy crawlies, basically, playing on people's phobias.
And monks as well. Monks playing on people's phobias too.
The spider on Sarah's back was always a seminal image when I was a kid.
Possession again.
Ark in Space, the Fourth Doctor's era.
Well, this is where it really... once you get past Robot, this is where Hinchcliffe and Holmes come in. And let's face it, most of their era is homages inspired by...
Pinched off Hammer Horror.
Yeah, ripped off from various horror literature, horror films, etc., etc. And it's glorious for it, if you ask me. I mean, most of the episodes feature some sort of horror movie, because you say the word trope.
It's that gothic period, isn't it? The Holmes Hinchcliffe era is very gothic.
Yeah, and you start off with Ark in Space, and that, again, that's body horror. Again, that's the loss of the self, isn't it? It's the mind being taken over by the hive, if you like. Yeah, I mean, this season's one of my early, as I've always said on here, it's one of my earliest memories. I remember being horrified because I don't recall seeing the Time Monster, although I may have done. Well, I probably did. I was just probably too young to remember it, but I do remember seeing the Sontaran experiment, and I do remember being horrified the first time I saw Sontaran take his helmet off and seeing his horrible, lumpy face, and then his head deflating as well, which sickened me when I was a little kid. And then after that, my next memory is of Genesis of the Daleks, and it's not the clan that terrified me as a child. It was Tom Baker staggering out of the Dalek incubator unit. In fact, that whole section where he's walking through there, he's edging through. And they're making those weird little, almost like crying noises, aren't they? But as a child, the image that sticks in my head is Tom Baker staggering out of there at the end of that episode with one clutched, this horrible, it just looked vile. This, basically a mutant Dalek embryo wrapped around his neck. Then the cliffhanger, that absolutely scared the crap out of me.
Well, here's one of our interesting contributions. At Steed Stylin.
Ah, Steam B.
Stephen B, yes, on the... excuse me, Mark, have you been making friends again?
From New To Who?
Of course, yes. Votes for the Doctor and Betan, crouching in a trench as a Dalek glided overhead. The sky, a war-torn purple and grey above them. As I similarly crouched, tiny framed, behind the tall grey wall of the sofa's back, holding my breath until the danger in the form of both the Daleks and the scene itself passed. My first and most terrifying memory of Doctor Who, long before I became a fan or even liked the show. It wasn't ever so much about body horror, though that also terrified me. It was the images of unbroken anticipatory dread. Crouched behind the sofa, waiting for the vision to pass, willing myself not to make a single sound, the stuff of nightmares.
Oh, that's very nicely put, isn't it?
While we're on that subject, did we have sofas in our living rooms when we were young?
And I had a settee.
So did we. Yes, we had settees. What did you have, Hayden? Did you have a chaise longue?
Yes.
Or an antique fainting couch?
No, we had servants bent double.
Oh, really?
We had the settee. That's what it was called back then. Nowadays I call him Gerald.
I'd always assumed for a long time that Doctor Who fans must come from very, very wealthy families. I thought, how big would your living room have to be?
Well, there's enough room to walk behind the settee.
Yeah.
I know.
So ours was pressed back against the wall.
Yeah.
What I used to do is I used to sit in an armchair in front of the TV. Not exactly in a lotus position, but with my feet under my thighs, if that makes sense. Clutching a little cushion to my chest very, very tightly, ready to bury my face in the cushion at scary parts. And long-term listeners to the Diddly Dumb podcast will probably recall at the time I realised that New Who was going to be a success for me was at the end of the world, you know, where the Earth blows up while they're watching it, And as the final credits rolled up on the screen, and I sort of returned to reality, I realised that I was sitting on in an armchair, cross-legged, or as lotus position, with a cushion clutched to my chest, bouncing up and down. I hadn't realised I'd been doing it for most of the episode.
Oh.
Ah, he's sweet. The boys at 42 to Doomsday voted for the scene in Ark in Space where the Wirin fell out of the cupboard. Still makes me uneasy watching it. Next scariest was Fixed with a Sontaran.
Oh, dear.
Yes, that is really scary. They do that properly as well, don't they? They have it. Harry opens the cupboard. The Queen falls out and it immediately goes into the credits, isn't it?
Yes.
Rather than letting us see Harry fight off a big plastic rubber thing. Oh, yeah, and as Sweeney Geddes adds in comments to that, an effect totally lost in the omnibus version, where, of course, they cut out all the credits, don't they?
Oh, yes. Terror of the Zygons is one of the episodes that affected me quite badly when I was a kid, because I remember watching it, and I remember going to bed, and I remember laying there and thinking, my mum came in and said goodnight to me, and it was as she was walking out of the room, I can vividly remember this moment, when I suddenly thought, even she could be a Zygon. I thought, oh my God, I can't trust anyone. Anyone could be a Zygon. And I just lay there, terrified. I would have only been about 26. So I was about 4.
But that's the theme of possession again, isn't it? Basically, when Harry is... he's not strictly possessed, but...
Yeah, I don't have any specific memories from the broadcast of the show itself, other than vague memories of the Zygons themselves. But I do remember the effect it had on me. And funny enough, it's that, again, that sort of weird sort of Invasion of the Body Snatchers kind of horror, where people have been replaced or they've been taken over. That has stayed with me ever since. I still have nightmares to this day about walking around and everyone I know being either a replacement or being possessed in some way, having had their minds taken over. And I'm trying to run away to stop it happening to me. And it's a nightmare that I've had all throughout my life, and I still have occasionally.
M.A.W. Holmes votes for Zygons as well. That freaking Zygon end of episode lunge.
Yeah.
And Sister Lamont with the arm. That was scary.
Yeah, and there's that freeze frame, isn't there? It freeze frames on the Zygon. Is it freeze frame on the Zygon face as it's just
where
leaning? As Sarah's it's just, on the phone. Yeah, as it's just coming up, yes, behind her.
That's another one, like the Wirin falling out of the cupboard. It immediately cuts away. You get perhaps a single frame of it before it disappears. Yeah. Oh, scary, wary. And I think the scariness in something like Zygons is really intensified by how the Doctor was playing the character. By how Tom is playing the character. He's very moody and gloomy in that, isn't he? Pyramids?
Well, Pyramids, can I jump on board with Pyramids?
Yes.
Because I always found Tom's characterisation of the Doctor in Pyramids to be quite unsettling, especially when he's possessed. Because I think if there's nothing more unsettling than a very alien and very distant Doctor, it's that of an alien and distant Doctor possessed by something else. And when the Doctor's completely out of control, that's when the story's out of control, if the Doctor's out of control.
Yeah, all bets are off.
Exactly, yeah, and that's how I felt in the last part of Pyramids when I watched it, yeah.
Yeah, he's supposed to be the one who's he's the big hero. He's the strong one. He's the one who when all the bad stuff's happened to other people, he's the one who's still all right. So yeah. To see him, his will subsumed in such a manner is hugely alarming.
Yeah, it's worrying. Yeah.
Thomas McCambly on Facebook this time said, I had nightmares about the unmasked face of Sutek. The one that briefly appeared in the TARDIS in the first part of Pyramids, that strange angular jackal face was unsettling as a 9-year-old nipper. Watching it for the first time, March 3rd, 1979. Youngster. Ian Winterton on Facebook says that when I was a kid, our downstairs loo had orange curtains, and it reminded me of the interior of a Zygon spaceship. I wouldn't go near it from 1974 until well into the 80s. Android Invasion, of course. I mean, I used to be horrified. When I was a kid, they were, for some reason, regularly repeating the 1950s Invasion of the Body Snatchers film. And that used to scare me to death. And that's very much fits into Android Invasion, doesn't it?
But I think it's... Aidan was saying that the creepiness of the whole story is rather spoilt by the title.
Yeah, completely. If it had been called the Village That Never Slept instead, it would be a much better story, and I think it'd be more highly regarded. Calling it the Android Invasion is giving up the ghost, you know, completely right from the off, as you know what's happening.
Why are these people acting strange?
That whole first episode where the Doctor and Sarah are wandering around the deserted village and finding things like the strange 50p's.
And the calendar.
That's quite Avengers-y, isn't
it? Yeah, it's brilliant.
Brain of Morbius, of course, which I would have been taking to me on my desert planet, if JR had allowed me to.
Yes, it's...
To go to a desert planet, I mean, not to take the tape with me.
Brain of Morbius is just one long love letter to gothic horror, isn't it? And horror films itself, with the monster stitched up, the mad scientist, the couple drenched in rain, stranded, knocking on the door of the big mansion. You know, all those sort of things. A coven of witches, brains in jars. It's all there.
Frankenstein as well, of course, being the main inspiration behind this one.
David Kitchen also sneaks in a sneaky second vote for Keeler in Seeds of Doom. Bang, you're dead, isn't that scary? Slowly being turned into something inhuman whilst helpless to stop it is chilling. That's a link to what you were saying about Benton being told into a Primord in... That is Keeler on that bed in that cottage.
Yes.
Being fed meat by the butlers. Bloody hell.
Yeah, I do remember Seeds of Doom from broadcast, and it did scare the hell out of me. Even the great big massive crinoid at the end, towering over the house with its vines and tentacles everywhere, scared me. But, you know, I would have only been about five.
Dad the Assassin, of course, has got the third episode, hasn't it?
I have to say, my friend, The Matrix. My friend Nick was particularly scared by the funnily enough, although it's only a little train, the guy in the gas mask on the train driving towards him.
Talons have already talked about Fang Rock.
Yeah, Horror of Fang Rock is another one that terrified me as a child. I remember the scenes of. What's the lighthouse keeper called who gets possessed in this?
Reuben.
The scenes of Reuben standing, staring, with his mind gone at the top of the... Oh, no, is he in his room? I can't remember. But he's just standing, staring out of a window, isn't he? Or just staring off into the distance. Still in the image, which, when I watch it, even now, still chills me.
Fendal.
Oh, Image of the Fendal, yeah, that's one of my ones that definitely scared me loads. The whole atmosphere of that whole house, even when they're outside in the countryside and suddenly the doctor can't move as this thing approaches, that terrifies me. The other thing is, Hinchcliffe and Holmes were known for their horror, but I do think that Graham Williams did a fair bit, actually. I mean, Horror of Fang Rock, Image of the Fendal, Stones of Blood, they were all fantastically scary stories, but one of the Graham Williams era stories that terrified me and is another one I had a nightmare about was Creature from the Pit.
Really?
Yes, because after watching Creature from the Pit, I had a vivid nightmare that night that I was stuck in a tunnel and a huge massive green, well it wasn't massive green cock and balls, a huge massive green blob was about to roll over me. I couldn't move left or right or anywhere, and this big green blob was just gonna suffocate me. Yes, a proper nightmare from Creature from the Pit. So that would be one of my top moments.
I just think the whole Graham Williams era is a nightmare, isn't it?
How dare you! How dare you, Gribble. No, I think he does some good horror. Image of the Fendal as well. There's even bits of the Armageddon Factor that scared me. I like Evil Canine and the Shadow.
Really?
Yeah, those really disturbed me when I was a little kid, yeah. Do you know what? Even Kroll scared me. Because there's those bits... Because I obviously at the time I wasn't so... As a 7-year-old kid or whatever, I wasn't so fussy about... I wasn't so aware of, oh, that's a bad special effect. You know, as far as I was concerned, that was this incredibly massive... Well, this is just this super massive monster on the horizon with these huge tentacles that went under the swamp. And wherever you were in the swamp, you weren't safe from it. And there's bits, isn't there, where I still get flashbacks of my childhood fear when they're in the boats just sort of punting around and in the and there's people being grabbed, isn't there, and dragged into the swamp. It still scares, unsettles me now.
Ian Winston puts in another vote for Horror of Fangrot. Horror of Fangrot was the real doozy. I'm quite sure what that means. Pursued by a Rutan through my nightmares for years.
Oh, well, see, he was pursued by a Rutan. I was pursued by an Erato. So it must be green, slimy, blobby things bearing down on you.
And we know that the Rev has been pursued in his dreams by Leela in a fisherman's jumper. Thomas McCambly also votes for something in the Keita Time season. Following pyramids distantly was being unnerved yet eager to see the next bit by the pouring of the blood onto the ogre and the stones of blood. I've never been a great watcher of stories where blood is flowing freely. But seeing the stone begin to glow and emit that heartbeat twisted me enough that I took a bachelor's in geology, the most caddish of the sciences, just in case I could see an unstoppable moving stone. The two camper scene that followed in the fourth episode blew my 11-year-old mind in 1981.
Well, I saw it. The camper scene? In 1981? Stones of Blood?
Stones... 1970, maybe you saw a repeat.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, but I that scene where the stone's just outside the tent when he gets out and he touches it, that's another one for me, for my childhood horror bank.
City of Death gets a vote from the Poo Poo Monster, otherwise known as At Spunk Pouch. Charming. Oh, I was around 6 years old. Saw a man pull his face off in City of Death. My pants. Charming.
At least they're honest about their position.
Well, you know, I pissed a boat. He shut his pants.
Please, can that not be the title of this episode?
Nightmare of Eden. Was anyone particularly scared by the mandrels? And then there's Horns of Nyman. And then we'll move on to... Did you find Horns of Nyman scary, Mark?
No, just wonderful.
Leisure Hive, Megloss.
I find that scary.
Megloss?
No, that opinion.
Oh.
Right. Full Circle, possibly the Marshman.
Yeah, the Marshman coming out, and also the Marsh Fruit, because they split open and spiders came out. And then they bit Romana and she started going all weird.
That put you off watermelon for years.
Yes. So much so that I can't watch Dirty Dancing either.
I don't get that.
There's a watermelon in it.
Oh, really?
Famously.
Someone called J.R. Southall votes for Legopolis.
Oh.
And gives us a story. We got caught in heavy traffic on the way home from a day out on the afternoon that Legopolis was due to begin. A regeneration story. I couldn't miss a single moment of that. Had nightmares that we wouldn't make it to home on time. As it turned out, we got in and got the telly on just as the opening titles were rolling. And then I watched Legopolis.
He's such a wordsmith, that guy. Very good with letters.
Oh, I see. You're right. I think that's everything from Tom's era. I suppose... I don't think there's anything I find scary for the rest of Classic Who.
Yeah, in the Peter Davison era, I think most of the horror was just a bit weirder, wasn't it? I mean, because for me, the most frightening bits, and indeed, I asked my friend Dan, who watched Doctor Who when he was a kid, he's a couple of years younger than me, and he said, I can't remember what it's called, he said, but it's that one where the snakes go up people's arms and takes over their minds. And so the Mara, albeit perhaps not the end of part four of Kinder, the Mara generally, I think, is a really good, scary invention. It's very unsettling. You're right. We are saying unsettling a lot.
Simon Hart votes for Tegan possessed by the Mara on both Kinder and Snake Dance. Mm. I was especially scared by Janet Fielding's Mara voice.
I quite like the bit where she's hanging around the tree.
Earthshock, the most horrific scene in your life, Mark.
Well, don't mock me. It wasn't horrific. It was just, had quite an impact on me and my toys.
Yeah, it was more traumatic for Galen, let alone Mark.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think of stuff in Peter Davison's era that really stuck out to me. There's obviously Mordrin Undead with the skull. Not the skull, the brain. Sticking out the top of the head.
Oh, on top of the heads, yeah.
I found that very gross.
Anything scary in the Five Doctors?
Just those raincoats.
Right, Sixth Doctor's era.
That bloody coat was terrifying.
Yeah, the horror. I was going to say, I mean, you do start getting into the Eric Saward era here, don't you? And a lot of the horror, I think, starts becoming less psychological and more physical and more violent and more violence and gore orientated, isn't it?
Yeah, it's more visceral horror than implied. Yeah.
Because you've got, somebody mentioned about the attack of the Cybermen.
From Rick Moran, 7-year-old me was terrified of the Cybermen in Attack of the Cybermen, and for some reason at the time, was convinced they were hiding in my nan's loft.
But yeah, Attack of the Cybermen's got like the crushed hand, hasn't it? I'm sure somebody mentioned that.
Yes, I thought, and Paul, who's at P. Waring, said the scene where Lytton's wrists get crushed and bleed in Attack of the Cybermen. Still can't watch it to this day.
No, it's like so over-the-top violent and graphic for Doctor Who. We're just not used to that sort of thing, are we?
No.
It's quite shocking, but perhaps not in the way that Eric Saward intended it to be. Then you've got Vengeance on Varos as well, haven't you? Which is, again, it's not psychological or anything horror. It's just two blokes in an acid bath.
Yep.
There you go. How's that for scary, kids?
That's one way to get dry skin off, isn't it?
Timelash. Revelation. That weird thing in the glass Dalek, didn't they? But otherwise, that's fairly
upsetting. Especially when it's begging her, when he's begging his daughter to kill him. It's quite
yeah. Yeah, I mean, the levels of horror in this just aren't... It's a level of darkness and violence that's just not very nice, is it?
Yeah.
But is it horrific, though? Is it scary?
I think it's more like somebody trying to be scary. And these days, people would say, oh, they're trying to be edgy. Eric Saward was trying to be an edgelord.
David Evans Powell votes for the Vervoids roaming the dark Hyperion 3 corridors and killing people.
See, this is the thing as well. I think now, because this era sort of falls in a gap, doesn't it? Because it's when I was a bit older and stuff, so I wasn't finding as much of this scary at the time. And it's not an era that I have revisited as regularly as others. So I'm going to struggle to come up with anything particularly horrific out of these stories. The Candyman from... I know I'm moving on now. Shooting on.
Yeah, so we're moving to the Seventh Doctor's era. We get Gav R. Yen, I think, at the Mind Robber.
Oh, at the Mind Robber. Yes, he's one of the guys who does the Dalek modelling for the Eagle Moss range. And he also does a fine range of YouTube videos where him and another guy look at Dalek stories. And I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. But they go into detail, forensic detail about sets on and props and things on the Dalek stories, if you like that
Gav
sort of thing.
Votes for Mags when she was transformed in Greatest Show in the Galaxy. Specifically, yeah. Where there's a close-up on her face. It was so terrifying that I couldn't watch that story again afterwards until my dad had recorded over that bit of the tape.
And he, nice chap. That I met him at Hoo at Hoy Lake.
Oh, right, yes. You talked before about making other friends, Mark. We don't approve of it.
But, Doc, I was begging him for a Golden Dalek Emperor model. So, you know, I was doing good work.
If that turns out not to be my Secret Santa, Mark, you're for it.
Oh.
Only one more vote left here. We get a vote from David Evans Powell, who votes for the well-dressed husks. Advancing on Ace in Ghostlight. I don't remember that.
The well-dressed husks.
Oh, I think I understand what you mean. I'm thinking of husks of corn or something.
I was a well-dressed husk at the end of Hayden's wedding reception.
And also just something just to add to the end of this run-through of the Sylvester McCoy era. The truly terrifying thing is that I was born during the making of season 26.
Right. Well, that brings us to the end of the classic era of Doctor Who. And as Hayden is struggling to keep his eyes open, we're going to close it down there. And for our next podcast episode, we'll get as much of the McGann era through to...
That should be quick.
What was the last Dalek episode called?
Resolution.
Through to Resolution. Lord knows how much of that we'll get through. right. In that case, I think we'll draw things to a close. I think Mark is becoming possessed again. Are you going to sign us out, Mark?
No, but Hayden's the one who's possessed now, so it'd be the priest
true.
Can come back in.
Oh yes.
All right. Okay.
No, it's my turn now. Don't dump bodies in the river.
Oh, Mr. Oh, hang on. Is he a priest?
Well, it's the soothsayer, it's the priest, isn't it? But he's possessed now.
Yeah. Oh,
It's complicated.
Father Exorcist, we have enemy ships in Sector 37.
It's a trap.
Bye bye, everyone.
Bye.
Happy Halloween.
Don't have nightmares.
I need my boat.
Let me say the most terrific simple ghost, not scientific, merely supernatural gooeys of the day. Heavy footsteps in your attic means a specter telepathic is descending just to spirit you away. Yay! We are extraordinary fellas here at Rented Ghost. To be another you, we gather come to Rented Ghost. For a biography with ghostwriters, I'm not forgetting a ghost script. An apparition crippled deep inside a crypt. Ring Rented Ghost. An apparition equipped from deep inside a crypt. A ring rates a ghost.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum. On Twitter at @diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. It is liquid podcasting. Fit it in your ear.